I saw the new movie Civil War last week. I will give you a review and analysis. We will start, though, with Miss Taylor Swift and her new controversial lyrics on her album on the Cory Truax Show. I will also finish, if we have time, with a clip from a preacher that's not great. Sometimes I like to show you or have you listen to preacher clips that show you how not to do it and maybe make you more, make us all more discerning on what to listen for. And a couple other things I'd like to do if we find the time. But our primary two things will be analysis of the culture, a new movie, a newish movie. It's about a month old now, what we can learn from it. And then the biggest phenomenon of the year thus far culturally is the new Taylor Swift album. And it's criticism coming from Christian circles. That criticism is worth considering and giving some analysis and a fair hearing, too. So we'll do that and a lot more on this week's Cory Truax Show. Welcome to it. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or Threads. Look for my odd name. It will be easy to find. I do lots of things, but one of the most precious that I do is serve the people of Beechwood Church as their pastor for teaching. Beechwood Church meets at 10:30 on Sunday mornings in Greenville. And hey, guess what? We got new pews, and I dig it. You should come out and see them and join us on a good Sunday morning. Listen, I love the old stuff, the accoutrement and the trappings of old church. I'm a fan of it, and so we have new pews, and we're really excited about. In any event, come on out 10:30 Sunday mornings if you're without a church home. Would love to have you. Let's start with the biggest music star of my lifetime. I am admittedly a fan. I've been a fan for 20 years now. I've been a Taylor Swift person from slamming Scream doors, tapping on your window, and when you're on the phone, talking real slow. I was a fan from, Teardrops on My Guitar, all the way through these 20 years of music. And she's now 34. I have my own criticisms of her as a person, just an example. She's 34, writing the same song she was at 20. I mean, there's some emotional depth, but basically her life goes in circles as a person. It's not linear. It's not going somewhere. It's just fall madly in love, heartbreak, write album. Fall madly in love, heartbreak, write album. I've never been a big fan of hers personally. I've never gotten her personal appeal, like even men who find her physically attractive. I don't think she's very average. For all the people who are interested in her life, I'm not. I think it's kind of vapid and empty. Especially now, being married and having that level of an intimacy, a friendship with somebody else, whatever she's doing out there, dating world, totally uncompelling to me. But I've just loved the music. I think she's. I love the name of this album. Something about a tortured poet society or department. Yeah, tortured poet something. Yeah, because she has been a poet to me. I've taken some criticism for really maybe overplaying her turn of phrase, but she is clever. She's funny. She's a great songwriter. And I don't even mean musically in a songwriter. For those who are into music will know what I'm saying here. She writes a lot in 1-4-5-6 minor. Her chord progressions and patterns are fairly simple. And so what makes her special is the storytelling and the way she can turn a phrase to elicit emotional reaction. I think she's clever. I've been a fan. Now, she puts out a new album. It should have been 3 albums. It's 31 songs. That's too many songs. It has elicited, this album, at least some songs from it, a response from the Christian world. Because some of these lyrics that we are going to go over very specifically here in a second use language from biblical stories and would you might even call anti-Christian or her perception of Christianity, that she's got some barbs she shoots at the church and shoots at Christianity in this album on a couple songs. We'll get to it. And the person who probably most two people who most popularize these criticisms are people I like. Ali Beth Stuckey, I would argue, is probably the wisest of the conservative commentators. Ben Shapiro is great. He's Harvard educated. He's going to come from a different perspective because he's Jewish. I get the appeal of Matt Walsh for some of you. Again, coming from a Catholic perspective, he's going to miss some things. Ali Beth Stuckey is a Reformed Christian. She is, I think, really biblically well-established. She knows a lot of Bible. She'll use a lot of Bible. Whereas some other people who try to use a lot of Bible, like a Steve Dace, seem crazy sometimes. She's really level-headed. And she leveled a lot of criticism at this album. And so I trust her. That's someone I want to give a fair hearing to. And then I think he's the head of a subdivision of one of our Southern Baptist entities called the North American Mission Board. He is the young people coordinator, the director of, I think it's called Generation Send. He's supposed to be the one coming up with the strategies on how to meet the next generation, the 18 and unders, where they are, and give them the gospel in a way compelling and understandable to that generation. His name is Shane Pruitt. He's another guy I like a lot. I actually said to somebody here recently, Shane Pruitt is my, he's my limit. I figured out where my limit was on internet provocateurs, and Shane Pruitt is my limit. He says some provocative things. Very rarely have I said, I wish he wouldn't have said it that way, where there are some other Christian internet provocateurs who just constantly, I go, you're kind of a jerk. But Shane Pruitt tends to say controversial and hard things, but I look at it and go, you know, that was necessary. It was hard, but it was necessary, and I think that was effective. So these are two people I trust. They're brother. One's a brother, one's a sister, and so the criticism deserves fair hearing. The paradigm I use in assessing criticism of cultural phenomena, movies, books, TV shows, whatever, is what I've given on the show to you probably 20 times over now 10 years, the reject, receive, redeem paradigm. I didn't come up with it. I've heard several different preachers of various quality use it, where we say there are some things in the artistic world, some things the world produces in their movies and their TV shows and their music and their books that we just reject. And we say there's nothing for the Christian. There's nothing worth consuming. We should reject it. There are things that get made in the art world that we just receive. We just take, I don't know, those pretty bad Christian movies like Fireproof and go, we just receive that. There's nothing else you would do with it. But there's the vast majority of things that you would put in the redeem paradigm. And I've given the examples before. You can redeem. I put a lot of the Marvel movies in this category, for that matter. My wife and I just watched a movie called Instant Family. It came out in 2019 with Mark Wahlberg. It is a story of foster care. Listen, I'm not an emotional person watching movies. I cried at least 4 or 5 times during this movie. And there are some things to reject in it, but there's a lot of redeeming qualities, and it's not an expressly Christian medium of art. So then we have to be discerning, we have to have the wisdom, and we have to have spiritual eyes and ears, not fleshly eyes and ears, to take in what an artist is producing and redeem it. Reject its bad messages, enjoy the good things. And that's the paradigm I want to use here. I have noticed, don't know why, I will not assign motives to people. I don't like when people do it to me. I don't know why she's getting some extra examination. She's getting extra attention. Some criticism. I don't know. She's the biggest thing in the world, when it comes to star power, at least in the music world. So maybe she's just, by naturally, she's going to get more attention. So here we go. Let's take every thought captive and analyze this new album and the criticism that's been levied against it. Starting here. Being a Swift fan and also being a Christian, I can diagnose for you her major spiritual problem. I've said it for years. She believed one of the American stories that love is your redeemer. Romantic love will redeem you. It will complete you. It will fulfill you. We have a lot of those stories in America. You know, the real story, the story that we should all know and adopt and make part of our core, not part, and should make our core identity, is the thing I am is broken by sin and separated from God, my Father and Maker, and I desperately want to be in communion with God, my Father and Maker. And I have been made right and brought back into that relationship through what Jesus Christ did. That is my identity. Son of God through Jesus Christ, now faithfully pursuing being made more in His image. I'm not my talents. I'm not the amount of money I have. I'm not whether or not my wife approves of me. I'm not whether or not my parents approve of me. My identity is not locked up in what I do. That's the story we should be telling. And I am now part of a movement. That's not just individual. It's communal. Now I am one part of the global church moving the world towards God's view. Not God's view. That makes it subjective. God's command and God's design for this world and all of our relationships in it so that we can see Eden restored in some way, us and the Lord brought back into right relationship and all in right relationship with each other. That's what I'm doing here. That's who I am. And then America comes along, every country does, and has other stories that says your problem isn't you being separated from God. Your problem is you don't have enough fame. And if you'll go get enough, if you'll get enough fame or enough internet fame, you're going to feel complete. You're going to feel like things are right. Your problem, the story will go, the problem isn't that you're separated from God. The problem is that you haven't had someone see you for who you are and love you. And if you could just find someone who will see you for who you are and love you anyway, that's what's going to complete you. And I could give you lots more. There are American stories. They're false stories. They are lies. And it's what generates a lot of our art. Taylor Swift believes the false lie. If a man will love you, here's the lie. If a man will see you for who you are, exactly who you are, not asking for any changes from you, will see you for exactly who you are and will love you, you will be complete. You will be made right. You will be made whole. If a man will see you and love you. I feel for Taylor Swift. She's only a few years younger than I am. This story is deeply embedded in a generation of women, call it 60 down to 30, maybe even girls now, where the stories their cartoons told them, the stories their movies told them. This goes back even, guys, some of our most classic literature, classic plays are just that. It's a woman waiting to be rescued from either her evil stepmother, or rescued from the tower, or rescued from her oppressive father. A woman is constantly looking to be rescued. She's helpless by a man who will love her and tell her she's beautiful, she'll be okay. This has enlivened and animates a lot of young women, and especially Taylor Swift. I came to this conclusion about, I don't know, 10 years ago. I was listening to a song by her that I actually like a lot. It's called White Horse. And I got mad at it. I remember I got mad at it because it was a particular time in my life where this concept would make me mad. And the chorus was something like, because she had her heart broken, and the chorus was something like, but I'm not, or you're not a prince, and I'm not a princess. I'm not the one you sweep off her feet and take her up a staircase or something like that. This ain't Hollywood. This is a small town. She's just, the fantasy she had in her mind is being broken down. And I remember listening to it, like I'm turning it off my car going, right, exactly. Why don't you all grow up and figure that out? We're not princes and princesses. We all have limitations. You're not being rescued by a man. How terribly toxic is that? We didn't come to rescue you. You are in Christ, for Christian women, you in Christ, you are made whole and complete. I don't complete you in that way. A spouse is an awesome thing to have. A spouse is a terrible God. It's a terrible replacement for what God does for us and our identities. And I almost wanted to look at at that time, like a 24-year-old Taylor Swift and go, yes, no man is a prince. Well, I guess there's a few on the planet, but we're not princes and you're not princesses. We're just men and women, all right? We're all doing our best here. And so I remember hearing that song going, all right, like she has an idol and the idol is romantic love. So we need to know that. That's the worldview that generates her art. That, again, is art I enjoy. It's songs that are often fun and sweet and tell great stories. Now, three songs. Three songs have gotten the majority of the criticism. Let's do it. First, one is called But Daddy, I Love Him. You could probably already figure out the theme of this song. The title might as well be the overarching theme of the beginning of most Christian deconstruction stories. Christian deconstruction being people who grew up in Christianity and then publicly walk away from the faith. I bet you know people. I do. I know people. Where ultimately, what's the real reason they broke down and left the faith? They'll tell you they started looking into evolution and they were so compelled by the arguments. They'll tell you that they really can't reconcile the hard things and the evil things that happen in the world and having an almighty God. They'll tell you all those things. But you know what really happened? Is they loved somebody. They had romantic feelings for somebody that their good church and their good family rejected. That's what actually happened. They had feelings. They had emotions. And their emotions told them, you must have this person or you'll never be complete. Because how you're complete in the world is that you find someone that you admire and get them to admire you. And if they admire and love you, then you're a person. You're a whole person. And so those folks are then willing. And this happened, by the way, a lot in the LGBT. Not that really. Just the L and the G part. Just same-sex attraction. Where the church, the family, says, no, this thing, this feeling you have is not good. We love you, but it's not something you should pursue, and we reject that. And so the cry back has been, but daddy, I love him. But daddy, I love her. And even this song just kind of lays out. It's kind of an anthem to that. It's an anthem to a young lady saying to her parents and those around her, in this case, it actually does sound like a church situation. It sounds like that because she says all the Sarahs and the Hannahs, these are very biblical names, and she uses some language that would imply a scene where a young lady is in love with a guy. Her family and her church, or churchy people, are saying, you shouldn't love that guy. This is a bad thing for you to do. And she just rejects them all and goes after the guy. Again, we all have this story. It's a young man for a young woman, or a young, ostensibly Christian girl goes after a guy. She'll reject everything. He'll reject everything because they got to have this one person. There's even a line in here that encapsulates it. I believe it's in the bridge where she says, I'll tell you something about my good name. It's only mine to disgrace. I know disgrace and good name don't rhyme, but they're an approximate rhyme and it sounds good in the song. This is what the argument would be. You are sullying your good name by going after romantically this person you shouldn't go after. And in this case, you are if you're part of this family, you're sullying our good name. If you're part of a church family, you are making a mockery of your church family by going after this person you should not go after because it doesn't match up with the standards. And that argument back is, my name is my own. And if it's mine to disgrace. It's an individualism, an over-expressively individualism that I've talked on the show a whole bunch. Carl Truman wrote the best book on it. Where we say, no, I am not of my parents' lineage and line. I'm not my neighborhood. I'm not my church. I am me. And I am me above all. And I have feelings and emotions. And I got to chase this guy. So, when you listen to the song, sure, that's a bad message. And so we don't redeem it. We can just reject that part. So yeah, that's not a good message for a song. She thinks it's a great illustration. I think her life's a great illustration. She just runs through dudes. She's most of the time seemingly miserable. She seems happy now. So she's a great illustration. She told a very unchristian story in a song, and it's not working out well. What I don't understand is this thing that she just laid out. It's almost every Disney princess. It's just Moana. It happens to not be a love story for Moana. It's just her own self-actualization. It is the story of Little Mermaid. And we just... But Taylor Swift said it. And I don't know why it's getting extra criticism. Yeah, it's a bad concept. We should reject it. We could even use it as an example of don't do that. That way lies bad things. Don't go that way. Okay, so that's the first song, But Daddy, I Love Him, because it has some churchy language in its criticisms. People like Shane Pruitt don't like it. I mean, I don't mind saying I don't like the concept. The song is clever, but it gives a very bad message. And I definitely don't understand like any kind of argument that would be in the logic world is called fruit of the rotten tree. I'm sorry, that if this tree grew this one thing over here that's bad, the song that is giving a bad message, the love above all else, then all the other fruit in the tree is also stuff that you should reject. I find that uncompelling. I don't think it's a strong argument. Next, this one probably is more troubling for some. I remember hearing it the first time for me and going, I don't like that. Don't like that. Don't like those lyrics. The song is called Guilty as Sin. And whereas the first song gives you this, it seems to be a scenario of a girl who loves a guy and rejects her family and her church world so that she can go love the guy. This song seems to be about fantasizing. A woman obsessed with a man and fantasizing about him. And the punchline of the chorus being, why should I be guilty of sin? Almost like there's a struggle here. Should I feel guilty about fantasizing? And then her argument, that's the question of the song, the argument ends up being, no, I shouldn't. I should not feel guilty about fantasizing, because what's really holy, what's really good, is love. What's really the best thing above all are loving feelings, loving emotions. And so the fantasy can't possibly be a bad thing. Of course, that's a wrong message. Of course, that's a really dumb and infantile? Yeah, childish. I'm trying to say childish and immature. And let me just say at the outset, yes, fantasizing is, you are as guilty as sin. I'm guilty as sin when fantasy, imagination of romantic or sexual nature are taking place not about your spouse. Yes, that's guilty of sin. And we want to purify our minds to not be people of fantasy living in that world. Now, that's the song and her argument. This lays it out in kind of religious tones, basically saying, you guys have held up the standard of whatever is pure, whatever is holy, think on these things, but I come to you with a better message. Pure and good are less than romantic love. So we should sacrifice pure and good if our thoughts are about romantic love. Romantic love is above all. And of course, she's wrong on it. But again, it's just basically the first song. It's the same song, same concept. If something is right, but I feel love feelings, I reject what's right because I have to have my love feelings. I have to have the thing that's going to make me truly complete, a man to love me. So I put that in the same category. Well, yeah, we just reject that part. It's just a song with a bad message. And this one musically is not as interesting to me, but yeah, it's a song with a bad message. We should reject that. Doesn't mean the whole tree is just rotten down to the bones and there's nothing to enjoy about it. Now, here is the part that really makes her argument and is annoying. If I don't know if the word is blasphemous. I don't think so. But here's the bridge, I think. What if I roll the stone away? They're going to crucify me anyway. Now, here is the key argument. What if the way you hold me is actually what's holy? Do you get it? That is maybe her most theological statement. What if the way you hold me, the way that we feel about each other, the love we feel for each other, what if that's what's holy? What if that's what's otherworldly and different and separate from all other experiences? It's not. That's just some chemicals in your head at some level. It's not a holy thing, the way you feel about a guy and the way a guy feels about you. But of course, yeah, that language. What if they roll the stone away? What if they crucify me anyway? That's resurrection and crucifixion language. So I get the bad reaction against it. I had that reaction too. I had a similar reaction a couple years ago when one of the worst bands in the world, Florida Georgia Line, wrote a song called Holy. I think I actually did that on the show. They wrote a song that even included like a chorus, maybe. It was near the end of the song that actually sounded like the old holy, holy, holy chorus. And it was comparing that romantic feelings to holiness. It was a point of criticism then. I'll criticize it now. But the angst around using that language, I wonder if this is compelling to you at all. I don't know if it's all that different than when Shakespeare has Macbeth talking about a character. It says that she died. He's quoting here in a little bit Jesus. He meant to use this reference because Shakespeare's using a lot of biblical references because it was the only shared reality. It was something you could reference in your writing and everyone would know what you meant. And he has a character that says she dies daily. Every day that she lived, I think it's how it went. And it was supposed to be take up your cross language, but the cross that she bore had nothing to do with following Christ. It was just other burdens in life. But it was imagery that everybody knew, and so he used it in his art. In Henry VI, I think it was, there was a character who gave up the ghost, and it was an alliteration. That's the word. The it was referring to Jesus on the cross giving up the ghost. There are some things in Christianized and even post-Christianized cultures that are just universal languages. Everybody gets them. I think you can slide that into this category. It's hard for me to think that she actually just straight up like went into the songwriting process and went, I want to blaspheme. I want to use language that really gets after this Jesus guy. I don't like him. She grew up in a Christianized culture. Everybody's familiar with the crucifixion and resurrection story. That ends up being maybe an eye of the beholder situation. You think what you think about Taylor Swift and you decide that she's using blasphemous language or not. I think it's, again, this is a bad message. It's not a good message for somebody. But to go straight up to, this is blasphemy, I don't. I'm trying to say it this way. If you think that, okay, I don't think you have a good enough case to compel me to tell me I must also think it's blasphemy. I think it's part of the artistic process. It's part of the canon of information that everybody has out there. And she put it in there like Shakespeare might. Now, the ending of that bridge, I think, is the one that's very compelling, where she says, if long-suffering propriety is what they want from me, so propriety, you know, being true to what she's supposed to do, if that's what they want from me, they don't know how you've haunted me so stunningly, here's key phrase, I choose you and me religiously. She's just saying that outright. You and me, what we have, that's the real religion. There is a couple other, but I've gone now almost 30 minutes. There's no way you've all stuck with me. I'm going to look at the analytics on this episode, and I will have lost all but like five of you like 13 minutes ago. So the only other one that's gotten criticism is from a song called Smallest Man Who Ever Lived. Once you know that song is about a guy that she had like a three-week fling with after her like seven-year relationship ended, it gets way less controversial that she said what she said. So yeah, I'll leave that be. And just finish with saying, we all have to be discerning about the art we take in. There are things we reject. There are some concepts on this album, this new album, to reject. There is some art out there straight up all the way to reject. There's some that can be received as is, and a lot that just has to be thought through and redeemed, including a lot of the Swift album. And let me just encourage that. Have your brain turned on. As you are, the problem would be is if someone heard those lyrics and those messages and just kind of took them in and didn't think about it. That the hero of the song saying, but daddy, I love him, and she's the hero of the song and not actually doing a wrong thing and not really thinking about it, that would be the problem. That's the thing I would counsel against in the end is taking in art uncritically. Otherwise, it's actually one of her best albums of the last... last five or six that came out, I think actually it's my preference. One of the things I try to do on the show is try to get folks to get some biblical knowledge and then run whatever topic they're thinking about, whatever art they're consuming, run it through that paradigm. And the way we're going to do that is being a people who are at least knowledgeable, getting some knowledge about the book that we say defines who we're supposed to be and how we're supposed to live, getting some biblical knowledge. I have advocated a lot of doing that with the Old Testament law, getting into Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and really knowing what the Lord gave his people to order their lives. And then I've encouraged you, think about how you can bring that into the modern day. That is sometimes hard and weird because you'll read a law about how to go about making it right when your ox gores somebody and you don't have an ox and nothing you own has gored anybody. And so while I suspect that's not happened to you, you've probably had no interaction with oxen. You might have had the modern day equivalent, and I believe that would be getting hurt in a car accident or getting hurt at work. And listen, when those happen, they are serious. You're hurt. You can't work because you're hurt. Medical bills are piling up, and you're losing wages because you can't work. What you really want to be doing is getting justice, trying to make everything right. I don't want you to be intimidated by that or scared. There are people out there who can help you, and the one I want to point you to right now is a personal friend of mine. His name is Samuel Harms, as in stay out of harm's way. You can Google him at Samuel Harms, H-A-R-M-S. He's easy to find there. You can also get him at 864-666-6666. Samuel Harms, attorney at law. For real, don't try to do these things alone. Get someone who can help. Samuel Harms is here in Greenville at 33 Market Point Drive, Greenville, South Carolina, 29607. The number is 666-6666. So if you have been gored by the modern-day ox, that is hurt in a car accident, or hurt at work, give Samuel Harms a call. Don't try to navigate it alone. It's 666-6666. I saw the movie Civil War. I want to give you just my reactions. I wrote them down. I actually had my notes app up while I watched this movie because I knew I wanted to do show content on it. I can recommend it. It's gory. It's got some gore, some violence that I turned my eyes away from because I don't like seeing that stuff. It'll make you think some, and it's got some excitement. It's an interesting concept. If you haven't seen the previews, it is the idea here of some journalists. They are war journalists, American war journalists, are in New York City, and they're trying to make their way to Washington, D.C. in the midst of a civil war. A civil war has broken out in the United States of America. And they make, in this movie, zero judgments on how it came about. You start the movie, and you're already in the middle of the Civil War. It's already been going on. And at some level, it feels like you're towards the end of the Civil War when the movie starts. They make no judgment about who the bad guy is. In all of the different characters, there's definitely some good and some bad. Like the president of the United States, this federal government, is not portrayed positively in this movie. But its enemy, one of the enemies is called the Western Front. That is a Texas and California alignment. So just having those two states together was in part, I think, on purpose to say this is going to be ambiguous about how or why it started. They are one of the enemies, but you'll see in the movie, the Western forces of Texas and California, they don't have clean hands either. The federal government has some garbage people operating, and so do the Western forces. They even make it more muddy because then there's some other splinter group called the Florida Alliance, and there's talk of something called the Portland Maoists. That's Mao Zedong, one of the bloodiest, most murderous leaders in history. And out of Portland, it'd be on the left, and they're absolute communists. So they make it ambiguous and confusing about what happened so that you're not allowed in your ideological predilections to blame anybody. And they don't make anybody the good guy or the bad guy. It's just a horrific war. To the extent, I guess I'm jumping to the end here, I came away from it thinking, I think the point of this movie is just a warning. It's to remind everyone who watches it, war is horrible. It's gross and sad and devastating. You don't want to. So no matter how bad it gets, don't start killing each other. Don't take up arms against each other. It's ugly and bad, and you don't want to do it. I think that's really all the movie is. And it's just a blanket warning to everybody because, again, you can't pick up an ideological bead on what the storytellers are trying to do here. Here's a couple other takeaways I had. The movie makes you consider that ultimately very few people in a civil war actually take part in the fighting. And that's been true historically. In our own civil war, in civil wars across the world, I think of the Balkans in particular in my lifetime, the people who actually put on uniforms to pick up guns, it's like 1% of the population. It's young men, almost exclusively young men, 18 to 40 or so, that do the fighting. Now, wide swaths, 40%, 50% of a country is affected because of supply lines and fuel and not being able to have clean water, because that's one of the ways you have warfare in a civil war situation is one side tries to deprive the other side of resources, not just trying to kill each other, but try to deprive of resources. So functionally, what it seemed like happened in this movie, although they didn't make it clear, seemed like whatever the offsetting event was, that some state national guards, like a California and a Texas, took over some bases, some military bases that were in their states, and therefore took over the planes and the tanks and the guns. And they started this war to... It doesn't seem to secede, like just to leave. They seemed like their point was to go end the federal government's existence, that there would be no federal government anymore. But anyway, back to my point. So I was trying to say functionally, it was just this small group, the militaries, which is it's about 1% of the country, actually doing the fighting. And they did a good job of giving that juxtaposition. where you would be in the middle of a terrible attack, like absolute war torn. And then the next scene, be a nice hotel in one of the nice cities in America, because the fighting is not in that city. That the fighting's going on somewhere else, and these people just are living their lives. But they do a good job even in those scenes of showing, well, in this place they're having to boil the water, or in this place they're having rolling blackouts, or in this place they have to turn on generators, and in these places they can't get any gas, because while their day-to-day lives are still operational, the quality of life has diminished greatly. One of the odd moments in the movie is these characters. By the way, Kirsten Dunst is in it. She, you know, she's a big star of my youth. They're riding through this town, the small town of like West Virginia, and this town has just decided, yeah, we're not really participating in this. You know, someone's going to win, and we'll just be loyal to them. We're just trying to keep our heads down until the thing's all over. And in civil wars, a lot of times, a lot of people are able to do that, especially if they're self-sustaining, like they grow their own food, they have their own stuff. Just a few more takeaways. If the movie was a warning against ever trying to have any kind of civil war, the tool they use to make that argument is what I would just call the banality of evil. How terrible people can be to each other when there's no consequences and when there is a lawless land. One of the things you see is that if there's a civil war starting, a lot of the fighting capable men do join up, which means law enforcement forces are diminished or non-existent, and so crime can run rampant, violence can run rampant. And then really, to me, what was the most terrifying part of the movie, it was right before the climax, the final stop before they actually get to their destination. It was like four or five soldiers. You don't know which where they're from. You don't know if they're from the Western Front, the California, Texas people, or the Florida people, or this Maoist group, or the federal government. You don't know who they are. They're just in American military uniforms. And they've just gone rogue. Committed mass murder in a town. Dumping bodies into a ditch. It's that scene, that whole sequence, it's horrific. In a lawless land, that's one of the things that can happen. Is some dudes in the military just go, all right, well, if this is what's happening, we're just splintering off. We'll do our own thing. We'll take what we want. It was another one of those telling parts of the movie. The photojournalists get somehow in between two snipers trying to kill each other from far away. And they end up getting cover behind this, I think it was a truck, and there's just these two soldiers, one with a sniper rifle, one with binoculars, and they're looking for the person who's been shooting at them because they're trying to shoot that person. And you know, these are journalists, so they start asking questions. Who gives you guys orders? Who's your general? Who are you fighting for? And they keep answering it the same way. And finally, the guy with the gun just says, a man with a gun is trying to kill us, so we are trying to kill him first. And it's supposed to give you those chills. At this point, in a broken down society, these people aren't fighting for anything they believe in. It's just, I don't know why this guy's trying to kill me, but he is. So I'm going to kill him. It's unlikely the guy, there's almost like an implication. Well, and the guy trying to kill them, he doesn't know why he's trying to kill them. We've just disintegrated into a people that are killing each other. Here's the one more takeaway from this movie. While I do think they made the movie just to be a warning, don't get violent. Don't kill each other. To me, it was also making a very good argument for just allowing a negotiated secession. That would be very hard. If we got to a place where this country, which is so big, I mean, we're only 100 million people less than the entire European Union. We're one country. The European Union, I think, is made up of 31 countries? It's a lot of countries. In that, their central government, the European Union, is very weak. Our central government is very strong. There would be fairly good arguments to make about a separation of some sort and the diminution of the power of a central government. And that's hard for a lot of reasons. Like, I just think of this. I love how safe we are. The Lord has made blessed the United States by giving us the four best neighbors in the world. A totally pitiful Canada to the north that can do nothing to anybody. Mexico causes us some problems, but a weak country that is no threat to us to our south. And then the two best neighbors you could ask for, the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean. It doesn't get much better than that when it comes to national security, when it comes to neighbors. The two vast bodies of water that you can't even come close to us because of satellites and radar. Like, we can intercept anything. You can't hit us. What a cool place to be. And so if there were a splintering, some kind of secession, well, of course, you know, Texas fires off and they want to leave. It's now in their interest to know, wait. Like, who is California letting in their ports? What is happening over in the ports of Virginia and South Carolina? Because now my neighbors are now, if you're Texas, my neighbors are now Louisiana and New Mexico and Oklahoma, and someone can get off, you know, a boat in Charleston, South Carolina, and make their way to Oklahoma pretty quick. So however those alliances would break up, it does become a national security concern. And then ports are a big deal. That's where a lot of our money and shipments and our items come from. So, our merchandise. I think the all I'm saying is from the movie is they make a good argument for not doing this, never fighting because it's horrific. But that also, to me, makes a secondary argument. But you might need to break up. And if you do, negotiate over it and keep it peaceful. Okay. I had one piece of audio I wanted to play for you from a preacher. I'm going to save it for next week because I like to go about 40 minutes, and we've gone now 41 minutes. And what we'll do next week is that clip from that preacher and also these Title IX. I'll finish there. That'll only take me 5 minutes. Title IX. Title IX is the regulation that oversees male and female equality, you can call it that, in college settings. The President of the United States and his administration has decided unilaterally to change Title IX to include sexual orientation stuff and gender confusion stuff to, in effect, make men who say they're women, women, and to threaten colleges if you don't also behave in ways and create policies that treat men who say they're women as women, then your students can't get Pell Grants and can't get federal student loans. It's lawless, in part because you have to pass laws. You can't just issue decrees. This is true of Republican and Democrat relationships, administrations. They both do this. They just make decrees now, and they don't pass laws enough. But I just want to toss out some good news. There have been lots of what we might call lesser magistrates just straight up saying no. Like, we're suing. We're going to go the right path. We're going to sue the federal government and go to the courts. But in the meantime, no. Like, we have some power and some authority here in, like, Oklahoma has stepped up to do that. I believe Florida has stepped up and said the same thing. We're not doing that, and we'll see you in court. The thing I want from people like me that think more like me is to recognize the process is important. Like, we look at a lawless administration that just did this, and I want us to take both lessons, saying the thing itself is bad. It's bad to declare men who think they're women to be women. It's also a thing that is bad to just make rules and not go through the legislative process. Because I'm getting nervous that people on my side are very cool with just using power that they don't have. Just getting the power and declaring, well, we're just doing it. We want to do lawful and good things, but we also want to do them lawfully. We don't want to operate like those who operate outside of the legal means of doing what you're supposed to do. All right, we're way over. I'm grateful that you listen. I will take any feedback on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or Threads. You can also give me a CoreyTruackShow@gmail.com, CoreyTruackShow@gmail.com for any feedback, if there is, especially on the Taylor Swift stuff. I suspect there might be some feedback on that. If you do have feedback, be kind and, you know, make your points. If you disagree, that's cool with me. I'm actually fairly easy to disagree with, unless you're a jerk, and then I really don't want to hear from you, because I just find that to be unhelpful. All right, I got to get out of here. Thank you for listening to the Corey Truax Show. If the Lord allows it, I'll be back with another new edition of the show next week. Until then, everybody, peace and love.